Welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at a Japanese anime classic, Akira, directed by Katsuhiro Otomo. Returning on the show today to talk about Akira is Professor Mary Dutter. Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show. Watching this movie, I could tell just how much influence, like I could pick up some, oh, that's where they got that from like, I just watched the show Stranger Things on Netflix, a big fan of that show, and you can just tell where the character of Eleven, this girl who's a psychic, who has telekinetic powers, you can tell where they got that from.
Yeah.
And I was never into this show as a kid, but a lot of people in my age were into Dragon Ball Z.
Oh, okay.
And you can kind of tell whenever he's getting the big ball of energy and his hair's all spiked up, you can, oh, so that's where Dragon Ball Z got that. And even there was this episode of South Park where I forget the story, but Cartman turns into this supreme powerful being and he grows into this giant mass that envelops everybody. That's, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's where they got that from.
Akira, all right.
So it's so funny just watching this movie. You can just pick out, oh, that's where they got that from. That's where they got that from, you know?
Yeah, there's, I mean, it's because it was such a big deal when it came out, not only in Japan, but in America and in Europe. And the thing was that the manga came out in 1982. And so it was picked up by the same people that were releasing Marvel Comics at the time.
Oh, really?
And was released through them in America. And, you know, it made a significant impact because it's obviously different than Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
But it really connected with the audience. So when Otomo made the movie 6 years later, and he was actually surprised that it did so well in America and in Europe, because he's like, I never really even considered exterior audiences. I always just was thinking of Japan.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I was reading a little bit of some of the backstory behind this. Apparently, he pitched it to get it distributed in America through Spielberg and Lucas.
Oh.
And they said no because they figured this film was just unmarketable to U.S. audiences.
Huh. I wasn't aware of that.
So it's interesting that it still found a fan base, even though people like Spielberg and Lucas thought there would be nobody to get into it.
Which is weird because they both like science fiction.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah, you would think that, you know, those guys would be probably more susceptible to it than others. But no, if you listen to Otomo talk about his influences, it's kind of interesting because it's very much based on 1960s and 70s New Hollywood. He was talking about the things that he was watching when he was young, and he cites three specific movies. He cites Bonnie and Clyde, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and Easy Rider. And he said all those movies were about trying to get away from your home.
Yeah.
And he said that was something that was he and his friends could really identify with. And so he got away from his home and said, well, if I'm going to get away from my home, how am I going to do this? How am I going to feed myself? And he's like, well, I draw comics pretty well. And that's when he starts getting into drawing manga. And he was active in manga and even early on with stories with animation in the late 1970s. So it took him a while to get established. He had a couple of works before Akira. There is a movie called Gimme a Gun, Gimme Freedom from 1982, which is based on a novel, a Japanese novel. And also there's Japanese, oftentimes anime creators will do these kind of compilations. So he worked on the Robot Carnival compilation, which if you haven't seen Robot Carnival is really kind of amazing. And it has my favorite anime of all time in it called Tale of Two Robots. And so you get all these talents that are amassed for these different compilations. And before and after this, Otomo is responsible for a lot of these. You've got Neo Tokyo, you've got Memories. A couple of years ago, you had Short Piece, which one of the segments was up for Academy Award for Best Animation.
Oh, wow.
Short animation. So he's really good about pulling people together and getting them to work on these compilation projects. So consequently, when you look him up as a director on IMDb, it looks like A, he goes through long periods of time where he's not doing anything, and B, you see a lot of things noted as shorts. But a lot of those shorts that he's doing is also contributing to these compilations that he himself is kind of authoring.
You just want to touch on something. You talked about how it's influenced a bit by New Hollywood.
Mm.
You brought up some other things that I saw. New Hollywood was kind of the whole rival gangs and everything that felt a lot like Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
And just how it's such a the society is so crumbly that they're basically the gangs are basically ruling everything. You can look at that reform school, and it's like nobody cares.
Nobody cares,
and it's just they're just ruling the streets with violence and rape and everything. And it's a lot of like Clockwork Orange and that. But also another Kubrick film also felt similar was a bit like 2001, especially at the end when Tetsuo is sort of being brought into Akira. It seems like a big bang or something in the universe is happening. That feels like the ending sequence in 2001 feels like, you know, there's a rebirth or something in the universe or something's being changed.
Right. The two things that you brought up I think are really important to Akira. One being that whole notion of gang rule, and there's a lot of sort of anti-establishment, because everybody in this movie, there's a ton of factions in this. Mm-hmm. You've got the unemployed workers that are rebelling against the government. You've got the unions that are on strike. You've got, I've got like a whole list.
The religious nut jobs.
Yeah, you've got, well, actually, they're not so much about the government. They just want the second coming of Akira to cleanse everything. So, and then you've got the colonel and his army who, at the end of the movie, are inciting a coup to overthrow the government because the government wants to take the power away from the colonel because he can't give the power over because then nobody's going to be taking care of the Akira project. And as we see, that's the thing that's going to destroy everything. It doesn't matter if, you know, you still have a government in place after, essentially, Akira goes off again.
Yeah.
So, and that's what he tries to tell the people that are on the executive committee. And the executive committee, just like a government does, will be like, well, no, we don't have a tax base for this. We can't really fund this program anymore. And, you know, we've got all these disparate groups running around and we're trying to control them. So we're going to have to put your project on the back burner and also kind of arrest you because we don't really like what you're doing anymore. And then you've got the rebels that are part of what Kei and Ryu are a part of, where they're trying to steal Takashi, who is number 26 of the special children. And they're also trying to take over the government in a different way. And you just have all these moving parts. You've got Nezu, who is supposedly part of the rebels, but he's also part of the executive council. He doesn't care about really what happens to the rebels. He's just looking for more information because for him it's all about gathering up as much material wealth as possible. That sequence towards the end where he's shoving all the money and the bonds into his suitcase, and Ryu comes in and says, we've lost, you know, the mission failed. And Nezu just turns around and says, what are you doing here? And shoots him and is, you know, trying to make his way with this huge suitcase that he can't even carry, which causes him to have a heart attack because it's so heavy. I mean, you just see so much of that anti-establishment of the Bonnie and Clydes and the Butch Cassidys and the Easy Riders. They're just like, we're fed up with the system. The system is broken. The system isn't working. And we're just going to do our own thing and try to stick it to the man. And you see so many groups in this movie, as well as the gangs and the sections of the town that they are able to control, that the police cannot do anything about.
They just let them roam free and ride their bicycles. And even they're killing people, swinging you know, wrenches at people at high speed. But
And they've got these beautiful bombs that are contained inside light bulbs, which I just thought was such an interesting concept of you know, something that's so incredibly fragile but also so destructive at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, everything is in chaos. And this is only like 30 years after World War III. So there's a sense also here that they're completely out of bounds. There's no way you would have been able to rebuild Tokyo and populate it with 21 million people in the space of 30 years after complete nuclear annihilation. But something else that comes up with that too is that, and there's even question within the executive committee, is the whole reason why World War III happened because of Akira, or is it because of just the bombs between America and the Soviet Union? And so they're even questioning the idea that Akira is even a problem. But if it's Akira that annihilated things, you wouldn't have the radiation. So that means you could keep things relatively stable. So I still can't think you can rebuild a city in 30 years. But
yeah, and I do feel that I want to keep talking about Tetsuo, and he causes all this destruction. He kills a bunch, and probably killing a lot of people with this destruction. But I still feel that he's a sympathetic character.
Oh, yeah.
Because I feel like he didn't ask for this to happen. He just happened to, I mean, wait, did he, one thing that was a bit unclear, did he get the psych, was he born with his psychic power, or did he get it just by getting into the accident with the psychic kid?
See, that's the thing that is a little bit, I find, vague about this movie, is that when you have Kyoko talking about, oh, Akira is inside everyone, it's just about awakening Akira and then learning to control Akira. Then that means that you and me can have Akira inside us, which I like as kind of a metaphor. Each person has the potential to create and to destroy and to become powerful. Some of us never kind of harness that, and we lead kind of normal everyday lives, but then we see the people around us that, you know, go on to have, you know, big positions in government or big positions in entertainment. So they've taken whatever that power is and used it to either create or destroy. In the material that's in the DVDs, it talks about Tetsuo's grandfather had been part of the original Akira project, and that the gene skips a generation. So it skipped Tetsuo's father's generation, but ended inside him. But there's nothing inside the movie that says that or indicates that. But on the disc, I actually own four different versions of this movie. On two of the different versions that I own, they have a glossary that's done by, I think, Pioneer, when Pioneer owned the rights to it. And when they have an explanation of Tetsuo, they talk about, because where you have the original kids and they're 25 through 28, Tetsuo's at number, and again, they don't say this inside the movie, but it's probably in the manga. I haven't read the manga.
Okay.
But he's number 41.
Hmm.
So you can kind of see how many kids or versions of these people that have had the power awakened in them have happened since the initial Akira explosion. Because if he was 28... We don't know how many kids actually survived that program, but we know that at least there's three plus all the parts of Akira that eventually become Akira again.
So it's more like the accident awakened him.
Yeah.
Okay, I got that. But anyway, going back to Tetsuo, I do feel bad for the guy because, like I said, this isn't his fault. And then I would kind of get a little bit annoyed and go a little bit mad if, you know, the government's torturing him.
Yeah.
And then even those kids start messing with him by having those creepy teddy bears and everything. Right. And it's just like, all these people are messing with him. He had nothing to do with this. This isn't his fault. And then you figure all these powers, you probably would go a little bit crazy with it.
And you've got to go all the way back to when he was a little boy. I mean, he was an orphan. He gets taken to a place where he's beat up. And, you know, he eventually becomes friends with Kaneda, and one of the things that Otomo talks about in some of his interviews is he really wanted to explore the relationship, the friendship between Kaneda and Tetsuo. But that's a very strange relationship, because Kaneda obviously is the stronger one physically, the stronger one personality-wise, whereas Tetsuo is smaller, he's weaker, he's not as vocal. The first time we see both of these characters, Kaneda's like, get off my bike. You know you can't handle it. So, and you see Tetsuo like, you know, just watch me someday, I can.
And the, one thing I was a bit unclear on about the kids, the other kids, you look at them and you look at their faces, they look like they're much older than just kids. They look like, you know, they're old people in little kids' bodies. And I was, am I right about that? Because that was the one thing I was a bit confused about in the movie.
Yeah, they're between the ages of 8 and 10 when they're taken into the program initially. And this would be back in 1982? When does the explosion happen?
88.
Yeah, okay, so the explosion happens in 88, but their files say that they were taken into the program at about 8 to 10 years old. So, and some of them are born in like 1979, okay, so that would be right. So they're that age when Akira explodes because he can't control himself anymore. And then we're 33 years in the future with what happens in this storyline. So the assumption is that these experiments that they've been doing on these kids have in some ways kind of drained or transformed mm-hmm. them in some way and aged them beyond, because they certainly don't look like they're in their 40s. They look like they're in like maybe their 80s.
Yeah, they look very old.
And they've been kept, and they've also experienced Akira and lived through Akira, which is also kind of an interesting thing. If we're only 33 years in the future from Akira, and the Colonel is in his 40s, that also means that the Colonel lived through Akira, mm-hmm. And the Doctor lived through Akira. And these kids that are running around in this world, these gangs, are post-Akira.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's kind of hard to place exactly the age of everything or where people fit into mm-hmm. the timeline. But you're right. Something about the drugs and the experiments that they did on these kids has aged them beyond, or at least mm-hmm. changed them physiologically.
Yeah, and that kind of leads a bit into my two complaints I had with this movie. One, I felt like a lot of things we talked about this were a bit unclear. Like, I didn't get why a couple of things were happening, or like the part where how old are these kids really? Because they do not look like they're little kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't even know why are they specifically torturing Tetsuo? Was that ordered by the government? That part I didn't know. And that was the one complaint I had. And the other complaint I had was Tetsuo's destruction dragged a bit for me. I felt like, okay, we get it. You're going mad with power. You're destroying the city. But how much more? How many buildings can you take down? How many tanks can you destroy?
Right.
It felt like I was watching a superhero movie, watching a villain go mad with power. It got a little point. It was like, okay, we get it. Move on a little bit, please.
Right. Okay. So to take the first question or the first problem that you had about timeline and what else was it?
It was why were the kids torturing Tetsuo with like the teddy bears and everything.
Okay, now that one actually gets to the heart of what I think is kind of another metaphor that's running through this entire movie, and that's overall distrust of the government.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reason why Akira is all bits and pieces in these little containers at the end of the movie and mm-hmm. is being kept at absolute zero Kelvin so that nobody can get at it is because they couldn't understand what was happening with these kids. They just knew that they started these experiments and they were awakening something inside the kids and they were trying to develop that
mm-hmm.
for weaponized purposes. And so, because if they had the power of what we see in this movie, you know, they would be an unstoppable force.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to figure out, well, what is this about? Why is this happening? You've got this weird little thing that the Doctor has that's this kind of rainbowy half sphere that's turning, which is one of the first uses of CGI graphics, actually.
Yep, I read about that.
And they're just trying to figure out how not only are they able to create this power within them, but how, more importantly, can they control it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big problem with Akira is that he gets to a point where he can no longer control what's happening with him, and that's what causes the huge mass explosion, which in some parts of the movie they say is like the Big Bang,
mm-hmm.
That it could literally just start a new world. So he explodes, they take his remains, they cut him into pieces, they try to figure out what's going on. We don't really see them continuing to experiment on the kids when we see the Colonel's project. And Kyoko is in this bed and she has these, you know, telekinesis or psychic powers, and she even at some point says, hey, I had a dream, a whole bunch of people died, but Akira came back. And that freaks out the Colonel because he's like, okay, well, when is this going to happen? He's all about the logistics of things. And she's like, well, I can't really tell you. I don't know. You've got the other, you've got number 27.
The kid in the chair.
Masaru, who had some kind of paralysis, and now he just floats himself in a chair around. We see a little bit of their powers when they're trying to attack Tetsuo because they know how destructive they can be, and they really do want to take him out. And even the Colonel at one point tells the Doctor and says, look, if this kid gets to a point where he's too dangerous, you need to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doctor, of course, does not do that. So you see this whole trying to gather power, trying to gather control so that it can be used as a weapon, which sounds very governmental.
Yeah, yeah.
And we see how ineffective the government is, where they have their meetings and nobody can agree on anything. We see that people that are corrupt, like Nezu, are in the government. So it's really just kind of a metaphor about how there is so much distrust in the government, which again is kind of perfect coming from a guy that's watching Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider, and that it's just kind of flowing over into this world of 1980s politics in Japan, which was very much like this too. I mean, ever since World War II, nothing against the Japanese government at all, but it's been pretty corrupted by things like the Yakuza. They will support individual candidates, and they also support, they also kind of run and control different blocks of different cities.
Wow.
So they'll just go into the places that they're running and say, you're going to vote for this guy, and they go vote for that guy. So once that guy gets into power, then the Yakuza are able to say, well, yeah, we don't like this policy that you're doing, or we don't like...
be ashamed if something happened to you.
Yeah, pretty much. It's very, it's really kind of crazy when you look at how their government really runs. It's in keeping with that notion, and the one thing that's really that I think is interesting too about this movie is they have built this Akira sort of containment world, and they're building the Olympic Stadium on top of it because they're supposedly having the Olympics in 147 days at one point.
Which
see
is sort of ironic now because in 2020 that's where the Olympics is.
Well, it's even more ironic when you consider the 1964 Summer Olympics. It's either 64 or 68, I believe.
It was 64. Yeah.
So that was the time where Japan was supposed to be showcasing itself to the world to say, look, we've gotten past World War II. We've gotten past all the things that had kept us back. We are now, you know, on the world stage as a world power. Brazil kind of tried to do the same thing, you know, when they had this, you know,
last year.
And so there was a lot of attention focused on Japan. So I think that's kind of brilliant that is brought back in, even though it could have been any sporting event. It could have been the World Cup or whatever, but they're like, no, we're going to have the Olympics here 30 years after we were completely annihilated to show you. And that's, you know, very much, you know, in keeping of what happened with World War II and what happened with the Olympics. It's very cynical.
Yeah.
I think that's so interesting about it because, of course, they end up, you know, completely blowing up and annihilating the stadium that they're building, as well as annihilating a whole bunch of Neo Tokyo in the process.
Yeah, it's basically like the same explosion that happened 30 years earlier, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of leads into the second thing that you were talking about, all this destruction, all this, you know, just goes on and on and on in this movie, and people die. You get that whole section where he does something to a bridge because he's like, well, I'll show you, but he's kind of, I thought he was trying to show like his little cult that was like, yeah, go, because they think he's Akira, and he's like, oh, I'm gonna get rid of the tanks, and no, he just gets rid of the entire bridge. So even like the cult supporters are all in the water and dying, and they're trying to like, you know, hold on, and they can't hold on. There's a whole section of academic discourse that looks at Japanese pop culture and how it deals with Hiroshima and Nagasaki and how that permeates movies, manga, television shows. If you look at the rise of kaiju, like Godzilla
definitely has nuclear commentary.
Yeah, all this sort of inability to kind of move past a certain point. Like we still have to kind of keep thinking about it. And I think that's why there's part of it is that they're still continuing on with this notion of it's not just this one small thing where something blows up and then, you know, we move on to character motivations or what's happening. It's like, we have to show you what this looks like and how much devastation and destruction it causes. And another thing, too, and this is part of a long tradition in anime, is that especially in science fiction anime, there's a real kind of one-upmanship idea of you have to try to make things look as realistic and amazing as possible. So one person does this building blowing up, and so the next person comes along, no, I'm going to do two buildings, three buildings, four buildings, and you're trying to make it as realistic, you know. So all the examples of like when the color or the light wall is coming by and the buildings are getting mound and thrown up and everything, they were really trying to show their artistic prowess by being able to show you what it would realistically look like if Akira were to happen. So that happens a lot in anime. Explosions and all kinds of destruction. Mm-hmm. They try to really go for it.
So. Okay. I'll admit, I've not... This was actually one of my first anime films I've ever seen. I think it was sort of... I know this is... as a kid, I remember the stuff that was on when I was a kid that a lot of people liked was Pokemon and Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah.
And I just didn't get that. And I just assumed that that's like what a lot of anime was. Oh. And so that just sort of set me off from them for a while. But yeah, this was really good. So just tell... For other essential anime films, what would you say? Because I know a couple off the top of my head, I know they're big that I haven't seen, is Grave of the Fireflies.
That's next week.
Howl's Moving Castle, Princess Mononoke.
Mononoke.
Mononoke, sorry.
Yeah. Well, you're hitting a lot of things that are Studio Ghibli. Okay. So that's Hayao Miyazaki. Yeah, anything by Hayao Miyazaki is good. I'm going to argue in our next episode that Isao Takahata is actually a better director than Hayao Miyazaki, but they're both part of Studio Ghibli. I would definitely say anything by Satoshi Kon. Okay. Satoshi Kon is probably one of the most amazing anime directors to come out of the 90s and the 2000s, and unfortunately he passed away way too young. But his stuff is absolutely amazing. So Tokyo Godfathers, Paprika, Secret Blue, or what is it? Anything by Satoshi Kon, basically, is good.
Tokyo Godfathers, is that the Christmas one?
Yes, okay. That's the one with the bums that find the baby.
Yeah.
That's a really, really great movie. Perfect Blue, that's what it is. Perfect Blue, which is... None of these... There's a lot of anime that is not made for kids.
And I think that's good because, yeah. You know, not just because... I think sometimes when it's animated movies, I think some people automatically assume, oh, it's for children, and that's not always the case.
Yeah, that kind of gets to me too because we're so trained in the United States to think of animation as being the purview for just children.
You know, it's Disney stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's far more ambitious things that you can do with it than that. So yeah, I would highly recommend Satoshi Kon. I'd have to actually go through and like look at all my stuff. But as far as things that come directly to mind, Satoshi Kon stuff. Studio Ghibli stuff. It all kind of depends because anime is so varied. If you want something that's a giant robot movie, you can find, you know, a giant robot movie if you want something.
I remember the Gundam TV shows as a kid. Yeah.
And actually, he worked, Katsuhiro Otomo worked on something called Gundam Mission to the Rise.
Okay.
So he's been able to kind of cross over into that world too. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of Gundam movies out there. I've never really been much about Gundam.
I just remember it as a kid. A lot of they were into Gundam and SD Gundam and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. There's like 70 billion types of Gundam.
Okay.
So that kind of goes on and on and on. There are other filmmakers out there. Things like, Redline is a really interesting movie that's got animals racing in cars. And I know it sounds cute. It is one of the most kinetic things you will ever see. If you're somebody that likes racing,
intense.
It's probably one of the most intense movies I've ever seen. It's just, and the music in it, it's 200 miles per hour the entire movie. It's amazing. You've got, if you're into monsters and vampires, you've got the Vampire Hunter D stuff, Bloodlines.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about the Japanese anime classic Akira, directed by Katsuhiro Otomo. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying I am Tetsuo.